You're listening to episode 140 of Flick Fights, the official podcast of flickchart.com. Hello, Flick Charters, and welcome to Flick Fights, the official Flick Chart podcast. I'm your host, Nathan Chase.
I'm Hannah Kiefer.
And I'm Doug Van Hollen.
And it's time to discover which films are the best of all time through movie matchups, two at a time, head to head. And as we decide the winners, our chart grows and better reflects our collective taste in movies. If you're not already on Flickchart, head over to flickchart.com, sign up for an account, and rank all the movies that we'll be talking about on an account of your very own. On this episode, we're going to clean house and re-rank the heck out of our chart. It's time for a lightning round, no holds barred session in the Thunderdome.
Two men, hand to hand. No jury, no appeal, no parole. Two men enter, one man leaves.
Weapons?
Anything is possible. Chance decides.
Thunderdome. How do I get in there?
That's easy. Pick a fight.
All right, so first up we have Terminator 2 Judgment Day against Casablanca. Wow. So these are very different films. They are separated by, 40-something years? And Casablanca is certainly widely heralded and considered a classic by pretty much everyone in cinema. And Terminator 2 is also widely celebrated for being arguably one of the best sequels ever made. Certainly an action powerhouse movie, one of Jim Cameron's finest films, and maybe one of Arnold Schwarzenegger's best as well. I'm probably incredibly biased on this because Terminator 2 is in my top 20. I think it's a extremely well-made film, and the dynamic between the three main characters is such a great... How do you explain this? There's something about the fact that Cameron turns everything on its head and makes the villain the hero, mm-hmm. and causes the demure waitress from the first film to become the sort of almost anti-hero badass in the second film. And then the character that is supposedly going to be the savior of all mankind is this bratty little kid. And it just like all the weird ways that he was able to turn the entire Terminator idea on its head and still make it incredibly compelling and, very character driven, despite all of the insane special effects and action sequences and just over the top insanity. At its core, it's just a very human, emotional character drama. And I think that's why it's so amazing. I'm now not to say that Casablanca is bad. I really like Casablanca. I think also it's a really well-made movie. I really like the characters. I like the setting. The whole feel of it is You feel like you're transported to that place. The bar is a real lived-in setting. There's nothing I can say bad about it, but Terminator 2 is just near and dear to my heart for so many other reasons. It's just amazing. So my vote is for Terminator 2, but what do you guys think?
I am checking. I'm trying to get my side up to see where Terminator 2 falls on my chart. I know I'm voting Casablanca, but Terminator 2 I think is really excellent. It might possibly be in my top 100. It's really, really well done and a lot of fun. And definitely, even though I am on principle opposed to sequels, this is about as good as a sequel can get, and does a good job of continuing the story in a way that doesn't feel like it's revamping stuff or recycling ideas or even trying to be like as different as they can from the first. It really is. It works just as well by itself. However, Casablanca was initially for a long time, it was my number one. And then wow. I started my project where I'm trying to rewatch through some of my top 100, all of them eventually, but that could take forever because I'm taking a long time on it. but I rewatched it and it fell, but not very far. It fell to number 14. So it's still in my top 20. I still think it's an absolutely stunning movie. As I rewatched this last time for the first time in several years, it was new things about it hit me every time I watch it. Sometimes I watch it and it's individual characters who really stand out for me. This last time I was really struck by just the cinematography and the visuals of it. And it's such a well-composed film and it looks so beautiful and everything about it just clicks for me. It's really great. It was one of the first movies that I ever made my husband watch with me, and it was kind of, I was very worried that he was going to hate it because I was like, if he hates Casablanca, this is not going to work out. But it worked out. It was okay. He liked it. But it is one of those movies that I just absolutely adore. And Terminator 2 is really great, but it's not as great for me. It is 233 on my chart, Terminator 2 is, which seems a little low. It probably should be closer up in at least the top 200. But it probably deserves a rewatch as well. But yeah, I'm voting Casablanca.
Do you have any movies, Hannah, that you can think of off the top of your head that are you're diametrically opposed to in terms of what he likes and what you like, or what he dislikes and you like, or vice versa? That's a
good question. We have fairly similar tastes. Most of the ones that he likes that I don't are things that he saw in childhood that do not translate outside of the nostalgia. But we have fairly similar tastes. I'm more drawn to specific types. Our taste in visuals is different. He really, really likes a lot of anime cartoon styles, and I have sometimes visual trouble processing that. And I was really drawn into, I really like the visuals in La La Land. While I was not a huge fan of the rest of the movie, the visuals are very, very much my style, big and theatrical. And that's, I think, less important for him. So when we tend to differ, it's often on that path.
Gotcha. Interesting.
Yeah, that is really interesting. I mean, I think that for me and my wife, I think we both really love both of these films. And that's something that we definitely have in common, is that, you know, we're not genre bound necessarily in the films that we're super passionate about. I just wanted to double back to something that both you guys mentioned when you're talking about Terminator 2. I've been doing a lot of thinking about franchises and about what being part of a franchise can give you and how it can trap you. And that, you know, what you both said, I just wanted to echo that Terminator 2, it's still a Terminator film, even though it does everything different from the first film. And that's such an accomplishment. That's a really, that's a really difficult needle to thread. The problem is when you have something like Casablanca, which has to build a world from scratch in front of you, that is its own thrill, or it can be its own thrill. Right. Whereas in Terminator 2, we understand the world that they live in to a certain extent. We understand the rules. Mm. Right.
Right.
And even when it comes to the genuine surprises like the T-1000 and several of the astonishing action sequences, we're primed somewhat because we understand the rules of the world, that those sorts of things are going to happen. I think so. You know, one of the reasons that, you know, I tend to lean more towards Casablanca in this very tough matchup right out of the gate, this really tough matchup. But I lean towards watching a world be built in front of me, especially a very complex and complex world in terms of the politics and of the characters. I also, one of the things that I've always loved about Casablanca is the bitterness of Humphrey Bogart. I love really bitter male characters, especially romantic leads, because I think that the bitterness that love can bring into a male heart is something that is both rarely touched upon in cinema and also can be a really beautiful, kind of bittersweetly beautiful thing to watch. To watch, especially in the hands of a really talented artist like Humphrey Bogart. I think that just brings a tremendous amount of power to that.
Yeah, he's absolutely pitch perfect in it. There's no doubt. There's many reasons why Casablanca has remained still to this day so widely celebrated. So we're going Casablanca here over Terminator 2. All right, next up we have Men in Black against Beetlejuice. I think Beetlejuice is probably the more creative film of the two. It feels, we've talked about Tim Burton's vision being portrayed on screen in a certain way. Even though he didn't write Beetlejuice, it's got his mannerisms all over it. Men in Black feels a little bit less directorial stamped in the same way. It's very well composed, and it relies on its star power and its effects a little bit, probably more. And it's definitely more slick and showy, but I think of the two, I would have to give it to Beetlejuice. But what do you guys think?
Yeah, I mean, for me, this is a pretty easy matchup. I mean, I love both these films. I think I probably would say that I love Men in Black more because for nostalgia reasons than for film quality reasons. For me, Beetlejuice is one of my all-time favorite films. I think that, you know, it's weird to just the right extent. You have perfect casting with Michael Keaton. I mean, like, nobody else really could have played that role. Like, it's this perfect moment in time in sort of everyone's career in that film. I think that Men in Black is a remarkably good film considering what it needed to accomplish. I mean, it was kind of a challenging story and world for it to create. I liked the aliens that it created, both in terms of their character and the special effects. I thought it was really interesting. I'm a huge fan of sci-fi guns too. So just as a connoisseur of sci-fi guns, it's definitely a touchstone for me. Yeah, but I'm definitely going Beetlejuice here.
Yeah, I cannot disagree. I think Beetlejuice is great. We talked when we did our Pee-wee's Big Adventure episode, we got some comparisons there between Beetlejuice and Pee-wee Herman as sort of this big character that runs the show. But Beetlejuice here is, his character is anchored. His character has somebody to play off of. And I think it really does, it does wonders with the movie and makes, we are able to see him and his antics and his over the top responses to things, not trying to see them from his perspective, but from those who have to interact with him and have to figure out how to deal with him. And so we're with the protagonist. Men in Black is a lot of fun, but it doesn't have, I don't think it's as creatively done. And, it definitely isn't as Nathan, you're right. There's not much of a directorial stamp on it. The visuals serve the story, but don't do a lot more. But Beetlejuice is great. But I think they're both pretty good. But I'm voting Beetlejuice.
All right, Beetlejuice beats Men in Black.
See, now one thing that about Beetlejuice has always bothered me, and it's such a minor point, but it's really stood out when Alec Baldwin draws the door. In chalk, and he draws the doorknob, and then the door opens. It opens backwards. They could have recut that, right? Or just flipped the film in the lens, and we wouldn't have noticed.
Maybe they did it just on purpose, just to.
That sounds like something Burton would do. Let's see if they notice.
Yeah. Okay. Next up, we have Face Off against Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. This is the John Woo, Travolta, Nick Cage action thriller against Willy Wonka from 1971. Willy Wonka is definitely the better film. Face Off is silly, good, but silly. Silly to a point of probably being ridiculous. Whereas Willy Wonka's ridiculousness is housed in a childlike wonder. Face Off's ridiculousness is housed in just, I don't know, it's just an insane movie. I, I do need to rewatch Face Off because I remember really liking it when I saw it. And I bet it doesn't hold up well at all. But that's, I don't know. I'd have to see it again to see. What do you guys think?
All right. So Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory was not a movie I saw as a kid. I read the book, but I didn't see the movie until I was an adult. And it does not work for me very well. I find it, it doesn't, I don't think that it, I'm trying to figure out how to say this. If there's a line between sort of a dark fantasy and just creepy nightmare that I don't think that it walks as successfully as I want it to. And I find it kind of genuinely upsetting to see even these badly behaved children smushed through pipes. The first time I watched it, even knowing the story, like I watched it and felt genuine discomfort for their situation. And it's like, I don't think this is really unpleasant to me. I think it's got some great songs. And I think Gene Wilder is really interesting as Willy Wonka, but it doesn't work for me. Face Off is ridiculous. And I kind of love it. It is completely ridiculous. But I have such a fondness for action movies that are like, we're just going to go for it. Every crazy idea we have, we are going to make this happen. And I really enjoy it's definitely a very specific feel and mood. And if you're not ready for that, it's going to be just the stupidest thing I've ever seen. But it hit me in, and I just had so much fun watching the ludicrous idea and the way over the top acting from both Nick Cage and John Travolta. And it was so much fun. I think I would probably agree with you that Wonka is the better movie, but I would much rather watch Face Off again. So I'm voting Face Off.
All right.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I saw Willy Wonka as a child throughout my childhood and on gradually into my adulthood, and then it gradually occurred to me that this is a really, really 70s movie, and that and that Gene Wilder is not really in it enough. Like he is in the scenes, but the magical, beautiful, hilarious parts that we all remember when we think about that film,
it's all him.
Yeah, it's like 10% of the time that you spend looking at the screen. The rest of the time it's, you know, watching old men burp as they float, and there's like half of teacups and that whole thing with Slugsworth, which we're supposed to be like all like intimidated by, and then oh, it's a twist at the end, but no one remembers that and who cares. Like we don't care about the Slugsworth twist by the end. So yeah, I unfortunately I've fallen out of love with it a little bit. And as for Face Off, I love Face Off unironically. I don't think that it's any more over the top than any other similarly tiered action film from the era, and you know, from you know, with a similar budget. I think that Cage and what's his name? Everyone
Travolta.
In it. Travolta, they act the way they always act. I mean, you know, they act for what the characters are. Right. And like the reason why they made the film about these characters is because they are like that. Like if they had if they acted differently, then it would not be a filmable film. I kind of work backwards that way. I'm also I automatically give an edge to any film that contains a prison riot. That's another one of my favorite tropes. I love prison riots. So this is a surprisingly to a lot of people, this is a very strong win for Face Off for me.
Wow. All right.
Ooh, I did not anticipate that.
There you have it, folks. Face Off is going to beat Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. Okay, next up we have Lost in Translation against This Is Spinal Tap. A mockumentary against a unusual drama. I don't know how else to what genre to put Lost in Translation in. It's not a romance per se. No. It's just a drama.
Yeah.
Right. It's not even a dramedy because that Bill Murray is only bittersweet. He's not even completely sweet.
Spinal Tap is kind of the prototype for mockumentaries. There might have been some before that, but it feels like Spinal Tap was the one to really kind of push the envelope and turn it up to 11 and make its mark in that particular genre, that style of making it look and feel like a documentary, but it's just chock full of jokes from top to bottom. I probably would have to check my chart to see exactly where this comes out.
I think we need to have a no checking of the chart rule. Because if it's just three people checking their charts, then it's not an interesting
that's
show.
True.
So
that's
no
true.
Checking.
I was only checking because I was curious where Terminator 2 was.
Right. After the fact, after you've made up your decision, then you there can you just out of curiosity check your chart. All right. So Doug has spoken.
Yeah. So I'm going to say probably Spinal Tap here. And that's unusual for me because comedies don't usually work that well for me. But I feel like because of its place in cinema and the fact that most of the jokes land well and the characters are just so insane and well developed, I guess, and Rob Reiner as the sort of filmmaker slash manager slash guy that he's, I don't know, there's just a lot of unusual things about Spinal Tap that makes it stick out for me. Lost in Translation, I felt like it was a really well-made film. I probably won't ever see it again. but I do think, and you know, we've talked about this before, but I think it's the tone, it's the dynamic between Scarlett Johansson and Bill Murray that's really good. The way that it makes you feel like you're in a different place. It's got a lot going for it, but I think I'll probably give Spinal Tap the nod on this one.
Yeah, this is a tough call for me.
You're a big Spinal Tap fan too?
I am. I was thinking about it. I'm pretty sure Spinal Tap was one of the movies I gave you for your movie challenge.
Because
I remember being very excited because I was nervous about suggesting. I had two comedies that I suggested to you and they both landed pretty well. I didn't know if that was going to work out. Spinal Tap was for a while in my top 20. It's not anymore. The last time I watched it, I remember realizing that a lot more of it is that the jokes that I love most are kind of surrounded by a lot of more, not quite filler, because you can still find stuff in there too, but there's a lot of like middle stuff, which I think it's one that I might be remembering slightly more fondly than it actually would be to sit down and watch it. But the highs of Spinal Tap are so good. And like the Stonehenge, the Stonehenge scene alone is
that whole bit is great.
Is so good. And probably stands above anything. Although I really like Lost in Translation, the Stonehenge scene alone is
right. If anyone knows where that prop wound up, if anyone knows which planet Hollywood that prop wound up at, I want someone to let me know. I want to pay homage. Yes. It's a beautiful moment.
And so I think these would probably be very close on my chart, but I'm not going to check it. I'm going to go with the which would I rather rewatch, and I would rather rewatch Spinal Tap. But I like both of these a lot.
Yeah, I mean, Lost in Translation is a very grueling experience, you know. I mean,
yeah.
But in you know,
in a good way,
in a good way, it can be in a good way.
You have to kind of psych yourself up for it a little bit, and like be ready to settle in and watch it play out. And it's totally rewarding when you do, but sometimes it's hard to get yourself to that point.
Right. I mean, I think that it's worth rewatching. I watched it by myself once, and then I watched it with my wife a couple years later, and like I probably need to go through it again because I still don't really get the journeys of each of the characters and where they wound up and the conclusions that they come to. I mean, and I think that one of the genius parts of the movie is that it's able to be left ambiguous a little bit, or humanly ambiguous, as ambiguous as any of our lives are, that it ends that way. And yet it doesn't feel unresolved, which is, it's a tremendous balancing act. Both of these films have this kind of the spark of genius in them. We're kind of pitting genius against genius here. I think that I would pick Spinal Tap. Again, because we had to create a reality kind of in front of us. I think a lot of that filler that we remember, which is definitely there on the screen, is the film trying to establish the rules of the world that they live in, where these people could actually be a functional band in their world. I did some brief research. It looks like The Ruddles, All You Need Is Cash, came out in 1978, 6 years before that. But that wasn't a mockumentary in the conventional sense, in the way that this is Spinal Tap is invented this kind of, firsthand mockumentary. The Ruddles was a kind of a proto Behind the Music for a fake band, which is, if anyone hasn't seen it, it's equally as funny. Eric Idle, super deadpan, as always, because he's brilliant.
That would be fun.
Yeah. In this matchup, I'm going with Spinal Tap. I think that it is more brilliant, and I think that it's more brilliant in a couple different levels, because you have the brilliant music and the brilliant performances and the brilliant improvisation, and then faking making a documentary is a difficult cinematographical task, and that was accomplished extremely well and extremely without noticing. So that's got my
point. You think about it too, in terms of, if they were to try to make something like Spinal Tap today with the typical American comedy lineup of, Seth Rogen and James Franco and those guys, like, could they make anything close to what Spinal Tap is? I don't think so. I don't think that their improv ability would be anywhere near what those guys were able to pull off.
I think the closest improvisers.
Yeah, I think the closest we get to something that, even this is clearly like, it's scripted much more, but I think the closest we get to that right now is something like maybe the Anchorman movies, which have enough improvisation that I get the same, get similar feels from them. But obviously that's, it's not a mockumentary. It's a very different kind of story, but that's the closest that I could think to where this would be to me now. One of the reasons that I hesitated about giving it to Spinal Tap was because I think that this, the mockumentary got a lot more, I look at something like Waiting for Guffman just, some years later with much the same group. And I think it's a little bit more refined and a little bit smoother and a little bit more solid throughout. But Spinal Tap is great. And I love what it kind of pushed this genre forward that then kind of took over for a while.
Yeah, Christopher Guest has kind of gone on and to do lots of the same type of mockumentary stuff with Mighty Wind and Best in Show, and they keep it up. They're kind of keeping this genre alive and refining it every time. It feels like they're just on a roll.
We don't see mockumentaries in movies anymore so much, but it's still like it was a huge TV thing. A lot of the biggest shows were mockumentaries for a while.
Right. I mean,
so it kind of spread everywhere.
Exactly. Like, there's something magical about those sort of cutaways, talking to the camera, that kind of that ebb and flow between things that are happening and then people talking about what's happening. I think that just the absurdity of that, of us, now we're watching them talking about this thing that is used to happen. I think that's the huge part of what we're making fun of.
Yeah.
Right. It's like The Office did that.
Yeah. Yeah. Too.
Yeah. That's
absolutely
great success. Okay. So yeah, I checked my chart while we were chatting, and this would definitely be a jump for me, because Spinal Tap was my 720 and Lost in Translation was my 680. Mm. So it would definitely be a jump. Mm-hmm. But they're pretty close on the chart. So that makes sense that it would be a potential hard one to make the decision on.
Yeah.
So, but we're all in agreement.
Yeah.
Spinal Tap is going to beat Lost in Translation. Okay, so next up we have Toy Story 3 against School of Rock. Absolutely, unequivocally School of Rock for me. School of Rock makes me feel great. Toy Story 3 makes me feel awful.
Yeah.
It's all about the emotional takeaway. I feel better at the end of 7 and Requiem for a Dream than I do in Toy Story 3.
Oh, wow.
Well, it's because you're a parent. So. You know, like your brain's all screwed up. That's why.
Yeah, sure. Do you guys like Toy Story 3? Because I really don't at all.
Yeah. Yeah, I do. I don't like it as much as I like Toy Story 2. I think Toy Story 3 was a little bit superfluous. But I definitely do not like School of Rock. I've talked about this before. I'm a huge Jack Black fan. This was not the role for him. I don't quite get it. I liked Toy Story 3. I thought some of the new characters they brought in was good. I also like heist films of all different kinds. I also like children's movies that do not shy away from genuine horror and danger, but not in shocking ways, in just really honest, good filmmaking ways. I think that a lot of times when children's films try to water down negative elements, you wind up with something that's cinematically weaker. And one thing that Pixar has been so good at is being able to find that balance, being able to still make movies for children that are emotionally honest. And I think that Toy Story 3 definitely falls into that category for me. It's definitely a downer, I think by this point in this series, I think we all knew that that's how this was going to go.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is interesting because we've got Nathan who doesn't like Toy Story 3 and Doug who doesn't like School of Rock, and I like them both. Toy Story 3, I mean, I don't think it should have existed because Toy Story was all we needed. but if you're going to do a continuation of the story, I liked what they did, that they took the themes of the whole Toy Story saga is. So many themes of it's all about like this life is fleeting. It's these very dark themes for a kid's story.
Depression.
Yeah, loss and depression and identity and like what we have right now will not last forever, but let's enjoy it while it lasts.
Which is so ironic for objects made out of plastic, which will outlive us all.
Yes, yes. Yeah. But I did not find Toy Story 3 depressing or really a downer. I found it, maybe it ties into the fact that I have a tendency toward expecting the worst in things. And so I really enjoy when movies can take something and say, okay, so this is the bad thing that's going to happen. This is why we're going to be okay anyway. And I find that a really uplifting message for me, saying, okay, these are the this is probably going to happen. This is what's going to happen. This is the changes. This is how we're losing what we had before. And this is how that still can be a good thing. And this is how we are still stronger than that. And I really like that in Toy Story 3, that we have these struggle from these characters who really have that attachment and don't know how they're going to. Don't know what they're going to do, and that it takes them and says, "We'll be okay. We'll be okay." And I really like that. That does give me warm fuzzies and make me happy and make me feel more positive about things. And School of Rock is so much fun. And so this on the flip side, we have something that's happy and more of a it's a higher energy and more positivity throughout, and not really. I don't know. I feel like. This is a really tough matchup for me. I think today I'm going to go with School of Rock. But if you ask me again tomorrow, it might be different. If you ask me again in 5 minutes, it might be different.
Right.
So I'll go with School of Rock for now. But it's a tough call for me. I think both of these are great.
All right. School of Rock is going to beat Toy Story 3. All right, next up we have Dead Poets Society against Spider-Man. So this is the original Sam Raimi Spider-Man from 2002. Not really sure how to approach this. Spider-Man was a pretty early success in terms of bringing the superhero sort of tidal wave to Hollywood. I think it was the one to say, okay, look at how much money we can really make with comic books. Because they had tried various things before, but Spider-Man, for some reason, I don't know if it was a combination of Sam Raimi or Tobey Maguire or what it was that made it work for cinema. But it maybe it's just that the CG was almost ready at that time, and they were trying things and making to try to make Spider-Man work. I bet it doesn't hold up. I liked it in 2002, but I'm sure that the effects are pretty wonky if you go back and look at them now. I imagine that the overall arc of the story isn't nearly as good as I remember it. Willem Dafoe is cool as the villain, but I don't remember if he has a particularly great resolution for his character in the movie. It kind of bleeds over into the second film slightly, if I recall correctly. Dead Poets Society, I think, is probably the stronger story in terms of just a solid character drama, really well told, really well acted, solid script. Robin Williams doing, you know, his finest work, really. Between that and maybe Good Will Hunting and a couple others, where he really just nails that dramatic leading role and is able to skirt off his comedic style and just be the straight man and make it work. So I think of these two, I would probably say Dead Poets Society is the better film. What do you think?
I think this is an interesting matchup. I loved Spider-Man when I first saw it. I saw it multiple times. I thought it was just great. I was, for some reason, like, really connected to the story. I would have been like 17, if I'm, 16-ish when it came out. So I think there was a little bit of the angsty teen in me that really connected to that. I don't know that it would hold up if I watched it again. I don't know that it would connect with me quite as strongly. Dead Poets Society, I watched not that long ago, and also that was really excellent. These kind of were on similar playing fields for me until Nathan, you were talking and brought up Robin Williams' performance. And I was like, you know what? I think that's going to be the deciding factor for me, because there really is some tremendous acting in Dead Poets Society, but Robin Williams is so good in that. And hadn't done a lot of serious anything before this. I think you're right. I think it's one of his, if not his finest role. And he's so good and communicates such compassion and such thoughtfulness for his students. And Tobey Maguire is not that good. So Robin Williams' performance, I think, is going to be the deciding factor for me, because I think it makes the movie stronger as a whole.
It makes everybody who watches it feel like, I wish all my teachers were like that guy.
Yeah. People saying, I want to be a teacher so I can do that.
Right.
Oh, right. Forgot about that dimension for you.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean,
it turns out to be harder than it looks like in the movie.
What?
Make them stand on their desk.
There we go.
Well, I mean, certainly if it's Robin Williams versus Tobey Maguire, I mean, that's an easy choice.
Easy picking. Yeah.
Right. I remember.
It was
fairly even
for me until I took that into consideration.
I can remember sitting in the theater watching Spider-Man and blanching at how bad the special effects were and how truly misguided Tobey Maguire's interpretation of the character was. I never read the comic books. I don't have any idea about the character, but I knew that whatever he was doing was not, this can't be right.
it was just wrong.
Yeah. What? In terms of like, it wasn't compelling. I didn't care. Mm-hmm. So even in 2002, like it's not just that it was dated for me. Like I can remember in the moment feeling like it was the wrong movie for me. And now I'm not going to, I don't have anything better to say about Dead Poets Society. I think that it's an intellectually somewhat vacant film. I think that it says things like seize the day and let poetry drip from your lips, which sounds like they're actually telling you something. They're actually like reasonable advice that you would give to high schoolers. What does seize the day mean when you're 17? How are they not seizing the day? Like it'd be one thing if they were like, complacent, but they're not. They hated high school just like everyone. And then the teacher says it's okay to hate high school. And then, oh, their lives are changed and they're standing on their desks. I think that films like Dead Poets Society, they blame the victim. Anyone who's depressed in high school, well, it just means that you're like, you know, that you're not seizing the day. You know, like, look, anyone can do it. You know, you just need to like break free. Like, no, there's really nothing to be done. Right. Everyone's high school experience was the best that it could possibly have been. And you just had to get through it. And films like Dead Poets Society set the bar way too high, just both for students and for teachers. I think that it misrepresents the power dynamic and the potential of the American educational system, private or public. Okay. So based on that set of criteria, I'm going with Spider-Man. I think it's less damaging to society. I think I'm glad that everyone involved with it made money and they continue to make money for 15 years or whatever. So I think I'm going with Spider-Man here.
All right. Okay. So Dead Poets Society is going to beat Spider-Man.
I'm not sorry. I'm not sorry. I knew I was going to lose that. I had to get that off my chest.
Hey. That's fine.
That's okay. I was realizing as we were doing that, like that I had weird viewing experiences with both of those movies. Cause I know I've told the Dead Poets Society story, but that was the one that a babysitter watched with me when I was like 4. And then when I watched it again as an adult, I realized that the only thing that had stuck in my mind was the suicide scene. That it had been something that had been like in my dreams and I didn't know what to do with it. And my Spider-Man story was when I saw it in theaters, there was something wrong with the film. And so for the first 20 minutes when he's a normal human, everybody was smushed and flat. And so then when he became a superhero, he suddenly looked like a normal human. And I was like, that's cool.
Okay, next up we have Saving Private Ryan against Star Wars. How are you going to beat Star Wars here? I don't know if there's anything to be said. It's Star Wars. It's a cultural juggernaut compared to Saving Private Ryan.
How does it make you feel, Nathan?
It makes me feel fantastic.
Right.
Saving Private Ryan doesn't make me feel much of anything.
Yeah.
The one thing I think Saving Private Ryan is overhyped quite a bit. I feel like the opening scene is really well done, and then from then on I kind of get bored. And I know you're not supposed to be necessarily entertained or enjoying your time in the war, but at some level I'm not really connecting to a lot of the characters, and I'm not really even sure what their main goal is other than to find the guy. So it's it feels slightly less directed than I would hope for it to be, if that makes any
sense. Especially from a great director. Yeah, I mean, I think they replaced drama with realism, which is not a cinematic choice.
Yeah. Yeah, it accomplishes one, and honestly, that's a lot of the biggest praise that I hear about Saving Private Ryan is, yeah, it's realism. That people who have gone through this said this is extremely similar. This is very much what it's like. And that's a different goal than to create a dramatic story. And that's not to say that can't be a a goal worth having, to create something that's as realistic and as close to reality as possible. But I think it, if you do that, you of necessity sacrifice the a lot of the narrative elements and the dramatic elements that that make a story compelling, because frankly, real life is not very interesting most of the time. and right. we pick out the best bits to tell, and mm-hmm. we hype them up and enhance them. And so it's just a different goal, and doesn't, and since I'm so drawn toward narrative, that's a flaw for me in the film. I remember thinking it was okay when I watched it, but I'm fully on the Star Wars side here. I think Star Wars is great, and I think the first one is still my favorite. But yeah, it's definitely winning for me.
I think of Munich as another Spielberg film that is based off reality that I think does a much better job of towing that line between having a strong narrative and character development, and you know, using cinematography and mood and lighting and everything to great effect to make a compelling story, mm-hmm. to really draw the viewer in, and still be based on an actual event and making it feel real at the same time.
Yeah, I mean that's a really good point. It's a good example that shows that it is possible that even if you are quote unquote handcuffed to history, mm-hmm. That there's still a movie to be made out of it. Something else that can be said for Munich, which I don't particularly like the film Munich, but I think that there's a consistent feel to the violence throughout it. Mm. And I think that one of the mm-hmm. problems I had with Saving Private Ryan is that the first battle, that storming Omaha Beach, feels completely different from all the other gun battles in terms of their sound design and the visual design. They weren't filmed in any kind of immersive way, the way that the first battle does. And so whenever you hear veterans say that this movie is what it really feels like, what they're talking about is the first 15 minutes. They're not talking about the tank siege of this town at the end, which is filmed just like a normal war scene. It's fine. Mm-hmm. You know, it's really well done. I like the deal with the innovation of the sticky bombs, which is a trope that no one had ever seen in a World War II film, despite there being 10,000 World War II films. No one had ever done a sticky bomb against a mm-hmm. tank, which I like that kind of stuff. But it's a mm-hmm. conventionally filmed war film throughout, except for those first 15 minutes. And it's gotten this reputation as the super accurate film. And let's turn the tide on that, people.
Yeah, not to be crass, but it feels like they shot their cinematic load too early in the movie. Yeah. You know, they mm-hmm. they just. Well,
I mean, that's put it in out terms there of money. They probably spent it all there. You know.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
All right. Star Wars is going to beat Saving Private Ryan. All right. Next up, we have Pretty Woman against Stranger Than Fiction. Both romantic comedies. Coming from completely different angles, though. Stranger Than Fiction is Will Ferrell and Maggie Gyllenhaal. Mm-hmm. And Pretty Woman is Richard Gere and Julia Roberts. Also separated by, 2006 to 1999, so that's 16 years. I was never that big of a fan of Pretty Woman. It felt incredibly cliched even then. And I don't know that it's really that strong of a film. I think Stranger Than Fiction is actually incredibly clever, very creative, and maybe my favorite movie starring Will Ferrell. I think he is used really, really well in the movie. He comes across less like a man-child and more just as an interesting character, which I think is great. He's not typecast. He's not written in a certain way. And it feels like he's really doing the script and not improvising the whole thing.
He's acting. Excellent. He's actually being an actor.
Yeah.
Yes. Right. Yes.
And I actually feel like there's a genuine chemistry between the leads, you know, and it makes it interesting. And also really creative casting with the side characters, because we got Dustin Hoffman and Queen Latifah and Emma Thompson. I mean, it's such an unusual cast thrown together in this movie, and it's built around this incredibly high concept literary fantasy conceit, which is kind of cool. So I absolutely give it to Stranger Than Fiction. It's miles better than Pretty Woman.
Yeah, I think I'm voting for Stranger Than Fiction as well. It's definitely much more creative and much more original. It was the movie that made me go, I kind of want Will Ferrell to do more dramatic roles, kind of edge into more of a Jim Carrey genre, like that kind of feel, because I think he's really good in this and I would love to see him do more. Pretty Woman is fine. A lot of romantic comedies and action movies both similarly have a lot of mediocre movies that succeed on the strength of their leads and on the charisma of their leads. And I think that's what's happening here. I think Pretty Woman as a movie itself is fine. It's not terribly original. It's not terribly creative. It doesn't take any risks really, but I think the two leads are probably at their most likable in 1990, and they work really well together. And so I think where Pretty Woman succeeds, where you need a rom-com to succeed is that I think there is charisma in between the and chemistry between the two leads, and I think they're fun characters to watch just because those actors make them entertaining to watch. And that'll take you a long way in something in like a romantic comedy where it's hard to find ways to break out of the box story-wise. So I think it's good. I think it's, you know, it's one of the, it's like a three, it's like a 3.5 out of 5 on the rom-com scale, which is okay. Right. But Stranger Than Fiction is so smart and so interesting. And I forgot that you described it as a rom-com, and I kind of started because I always think of it so much about it being the relationship, as it were, between Will Ferrell and Emma Thompson as the author. And there's so much going on in that movie, so many layers and so much just really well done. So it's definitely a stronger movie and a funny movie and just a really good one overall.
That's so interesting. I'm not voting. I haven't yet seen Pretty Woman, but it was really interesting to hear you guys talk about it the way that you did. I am naturally suspicious of films that have really made a big splash in popular culture. And it's interesting to see sometimes it's for a good reason and sometimes not.
Yep. All right. Stranger Than Fiction beats Pretty Woman. I love the scene where Will Ferrell brings her flowers.
Yes.
And it's a box it's just of flour. Different cake flowers and stuff.
Yes.
It's like, it's such a great, wonderful thing to do. Like, nobody would ever think about that. Such a good script point. All right. So now we've got Alice in Wonderland from 1951. This is the Disney animated version against Dark City. Dark City is really, really cool. Very unusual movie. You can go back and check the Dark City episode of the show, but it's there's a lot of creativity, a lot of interesting visual stuff going on. The characters are creepy, and it reminds you of movies like The Matrix. And some of Terry Gilliam's stuff, and I don't know, it's a kind of a hodgepodge of lots of stuff that's come before it, but at the same time feels completely new. I think it's something that every sci-fi mindbender fan should see. Alice in Wonderland feels like a acid trip that Disney put on the screen. It's technicolor in every way. It's full of scary stuff and funny stuff and weird stuff. It's pretty cool in terms of being kind of an odd man out among Disney classics.
I wonder if they intended it for children. I mean, I guess on paper someone thought so, but I mean, I wonder if secretly, like, the screenwriters or somebody were kind of pitching higher.
Yeah, a lot of the older Disney stuff was not intended for children.
Right.
It was intended for adults. Like when Snow White came out, it was not made for
kids.
So I think maybe up until the 70s or 80s, Disney never really looked at their films as being for children specifically. Dark City is certainly not for kids, but yeah.
Weird.
I'd say Dark City is the cooler movie for me, for sure.
I rewatched Alice in Wonderland, I guess about 2 years ago. I was very disappointed by it. It feels very water thin in terms of the technical prowess of its animation. It is imaginative in terms of the shapes and the colors that appear on the screen, but there's no attempt to make you feel things by the shapes and colors that are on the screen. It's almost like an experiment, which maybe it was. Maybe that was its purpose within the studio. I applaud its audacity, but I don't find that it's actually a very compelling film. I don't particularly like Dark City. I came out, I was just trying to remember, there was this sort of like a quadrology that kind of happened in 98-99. So you got Dark City, 13th Floor, Existence, and The Matrix, where they was sort of like in the zeitgeist.
Yeah.
Everyone was doubting reality, like all of a sudden. And I thought that was really cool. That was a fun time to be right in my late teens, you know, where that's what teens are thinking about anyway.
Right.
So I remember it finally for being kind of part of that movement. I think I'm gonna vote for it in this particular matchup, but I think that it definitely has some problems, and it has definitely lost a number of matchups for me in the past.
Dark City I have not seen in a really long time, and it's one that I've meant to go back to because I feel like I remember enjoying it, but I feel like I would get so much more out of it now when I'm not. I mean, I think I saw it when it came out, so I would have been like 12, and so I feel I would have there would have been a lot more that I could at least a lot more for me to get out of it now, especially having seen a lot of those movies that surrounded it and seeing like how it kind of fit into that. Disney's Alice in Wonderland is I really enjoy the Alice books. I think both of them are delightful and interesting and charming, and I think I have not yet seen a good film adaptation of them. Mm-hmm. They have a tendency to play up the creepy and the acid trip nature of it, and one of the most important things about the books is that Alice herself is rarely ruffled by anything that she comes across. She's curious, and she's intrigued, and she's sometimes startled, but she never feels like she's lost control of the situation. And I think having her as that anchor is really important, because otherwise it's just terrifying, and it's terrifying for no reason.
Now, you don't think that would make her an uncompelling protagonist who seems to have no conflict?
I don't think she has conflict in this version.
That's true. Maybe that's why I don't like
it. So if you're going to make her... I think that the purpose of the story is not Alice's journey, ever. It's creating a world. And if the world is walked through by someone who is scared of what's going on most of the time, that's a really creepy journey. That's not one that I particularly want to go on.
You know what? What version did that was... There was a made-for-TV version in the 80s of Alice in Wonderland, and it was that. It was basically the most terrifying... vision of Alice in Wonderland.
The one with Sammy Davis Jr.
I think so. Yeah.
There's a version of Alice. Huge
part with Jabberwocky being featured, and I remember it just being incredibly terrifying. And the actress that played the queen was also equally just disturbing and super intense.
Oh.
There's so many disturbing elements of the story that are dark, and I think Alice needs to be, in a sense, she needs to be the Charlie of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, who is not really fazed by anything, is not like, oh no, my life might be in danger, I'm lost in a hole underground and I'm never going to get out. Mm-hmm. And this version, I think, it, like all the others, does not do that well. Alice is much more fragile, and I genuinely fear for her, and she's... and I don't have a good time with her. And I'm just like, I just want you to be out because this is clearly not fun for anybody. And so, I think nobody's figured out yet, at least not that I've seen, how to make an Alice in Wonderland movie that doesn't just seem terrifying and not and not unusual, but still fun and still something that she's going to survive.
There's an extension of the Alice story in video games called Alice.
What is that one
called?
Madness Returns. Something like that. One of them.
Yeah. Where she basically, the story is that she goes crazy in real life and goes to a mental hospital or something, and then she ends up going back to Wonderland in order to sort of reclaim her sanity. And it's like a twisted, upside down version of Alice in Wonderland, which is. In itself, it's already crazy, but
I was going to say, I think most of the film versions already kind of border on that.
Yeah, it takes it even darker.
It does not take much to push it further in that direction.
But the thing that's interesting about it is that she's now in control. Like mm-hmm. she understands what Wonderland is and she's fighting against it.
Yeah.
So it does that sort of thing that you were talking about, where now rather than her being just this sort of meek and demure scared girl, she's now sort of like, it's like she's the Linda Hamilton, Terminator 2 character in Wonderland. Like she's
take you guys
back,
down,
with a vengeance. So it's a total flip on that.
Yeah, but yeah, I'm definitely voting Dark City. After all that, Alice is a mess. Yeah. Dark City is fun.
All right, so Dark City will beat Alice in Wonderland. Okay. And that's a wrap then for this episode of Flick Fights. But you can follow us on Flickchart as Flick Fights, and you can follow us on Twitter. You can follow us on Facebook. And if you want to be a future guest on an upcoming episode, or if you want to send us any kind of feedback about the show, just email us at flickfights@flickchart.com. And from all of us at Flick Fights, thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you soon.